Welcome to The Critique. Today we are looking at The Sweetness That Consumed the World by Dr. Bechara Saholi, which is this incredible transdisciplinary monograph exploring how the Caribbean sugar plantation functioned as an integrated financial, ecological, and racial machine.
And the underlying research here is just, it's staggering.
It really is. So because the foundation is already so strong, we're going to jump straight into high-level structural refinements right off the bat to just maximize the reader's experience. And first up, the manuscript's pacing frequently stalls due to the inclusion of defensive caveats that interrupt the primary narrative.
Right. Yeah, you feel those breaks in momentum almost immediately. Like the text is constantly pausing to clarify what it is not saying.
Exactly.
We get these profound chapters detailing the sheer mechanics of the plantation system, but then there's a sudden disclaimer making sure the reader knows that sugar isn't some inherently evil molecule.
Yeah, or, you know, we hit a paragraph clarifying that race was utilized as a legal construct to justify labor rather than being like a fixed biology.
Right. And it makes sure to point out that not every single planter was equally brutal, or that the end consumers in Europe aren't entirely to blame for their appetites.
And, I mean, the core argument of the manuscript focuses on the system as the culprit, right, rather than individual actors trapped within its logic. But when you are trying to pull a reader into the devastating reality of this history, those defensive pauses, they just, they dilute the impact.
They really do. They act like speed bumps.
Exactly. Speed bumps. Just as the narrative is accelerating, the reader starts to feel the heat of the history, and then they are suddenly pulled back into this dry academic debate.
Well, that makes sense, but could the evidence also support a different conclusion? Like, I wonder if the author includes these frequent pauses specifically to prevent bad faith misinterpretations by historians or, you know, medical professionals who might otherwise dismiss the work as reductionist.
Oh, for sure. Critics will absolutely look for holes.
Right. So aren't those caveats completely necessary for a work of this magnitude?
Yeah, those nuances are vital academic guardrails. I mean, removing them entirely would just expose the manuscript to unfair criticism.
So what's the fix then?
Well, instead of sprinkling them throughout the narrative and, you know, killing the momentum, my suggestion is to consolidate these vital academic guardrails into a single, dedicated methodology and guardrail section right in the introduction.
Oh, okay. So you kind of establish the rules of engagement up front.
Exactly. By doing that, the main text can present its bold, devastating arguments with unhesitating confidence. You basically trust that the reader has already absorbed the nuance. You give the reader the lens, and then you just let them look through it.
You build the container first, and then let the narrative run freely within it. I can see how that fundamentally changes the reading experience.
Right. So, for a concrete example, let's look at the section titled Sweetening Industrial Life. There's a disclaimer in the middle of this fantastic historical passage that reads, to describe sugar as a cheap calorie can obscure, and then it goes on.
Right. Yeah, I remember that one.
That entire clarification can just be lifted completely out of the chapter body.
And similarly, in the section discussing the era before the plantation, the text pauses to say, the relationship between insurance and slavery should be described carefully.
Exactly. Move those specific clarifications directly into the preface or introduction where that guardrails against overclaiming section is already partially established.
So the historical chapters can focus purely on the mechanics of the plantation.
Right, because the reader doesn't need to be repeatedly reminded of the guardrails once they're securely on the track. The psychological effect on the reader is huge here.
Because when an author pauses to apologize or clarify, it signals this, like, moment of hesitation.
Yeah, it inadvertently breaks the fourth wall. For a book that introduces incredibly heavy conceptual frameworks, you need the reader fully submerged. Take the concept of emancipation without deplantation.
Oh, yeah. That is such a brilliant, heavy idea.
It really is. The author introduces it to explain how freeing the enslaved population didn't actually dismantle the exploitative economic machinery they were trapped in. The plantation just, you know, evolved its legal definitions while keeping the physical extraction intact.
And to effectively land a massive paradigm shift like that, the prose has to be relentless. If the author is constantly stopping to say, well, some planters try to be less cruel, it deflates the structural argument.
Exactly.
Moving the caveats to the front basically says to the reader, I know the counterarguments. I have addressed them. Now we are going to look at the machinery.
Right, it clears the board. Once you remove those academic speed bumps, the sheer brutal scale of the plantation machine becomes starkly visible on the page.
And, I mean, once you strip away that academic padding, the reader is forced to confront the physical machinery head on. But that actually creates a new challenge for the flow of the book. The structural transition between the physical violence of the plantation and the abstract mechanisms of imperial finance risks losing the reader in conceptual abstraction.
Oh, the leap between those two concepts is incredibly jarring in the current draft.
Right, because we move from the visceral, embodied realities of the plantation machine, so the suffocating heat of the boiling house, the danger of the crushing mill, the whip, directly into a chapter called Financing the Harvest.
Which deals heavily with, you know, bills of exchange, mortgages, shipping insurance.
Exactly. The jump feels totally abrupt. The financial section risks feeling disconnected from the human toll. It kind of accidentally mirrors the very detachment the manuscript is criticizing.
Wow. Yeah. Because the bankers in London didn't want to think about the boiling house, right? They only wanted to look at the ledger.
Right. By making this transition so abrupt, the book allows the reader to do exactly what the 18th century investor did. Just forget about the blood and focus entirely on the math.
So, a key theme running through this material seems to be the displaced balance sheet, which is this brilliant idea that the true costs of this industry, the ecological destruction, the bodily wear and tear, the staggering loss of human life, were kept entirely off the official ledgers of the empire.
Mm-hmm.
What if we use that exact accounting metaphor as a physical bridge? Like, we could show the financial ledger literally stained with the sweat of the boiling house, anchor the paperwork directly to the physical earth of the plantation.
Oh, I love that. Using the displaced balance sheet as a recurring visceral narrative anchor, the author should explicitly trace a single physical asset or, like, a specific bodily injury directly into a specific financial document, just to bridge the gap between flesh and paper.
Yes. The abstraction of finance is the whole point of the system. But the reader shouldn't experience the chapter as abstract. They need to feel how the paper itself was weaponized.
Right. So for a concrete example, when introducing the section on enslaved people as collateral, the text currently just explains the legal mechanism of collateralizing human beings.
Which is historically accurate, but, you know, dry.
Exactly. The author should directly recall the sick house from the previous chapter. Don't just state the legal reality. Show exactly how a specific physical injury treated in the sick house was instantaneously recorded as a depreciation of collateral on a London mortgage.
Walk us from the wounded body right to the ink on the ledger.
Yeah. And think about how a bill of exchange actually functioned historically. It was essentially an early form of credit, right? A written order to pay a certain sum on a specific date.
Which allowed merchants to conduct massive international trade without shipping chests of gold back and forth across the Atlantic.
Exactly. But its psychological function was just as important as its economic one. It created an immense distance. It turned the terror of the Middle Passage and the grueling labor of the sugar harvest into a neat folded piece of paper that could be, like, politely handed across a desk in a quiet European banking hall.
The paper basically acts as a magic trick, making the violence disappear so the wealth can circulate cleanly.
To fix the structural disconnect in the manuscript, the author needs to expose that magic trick. Anchor the explanation of the bill of exchange to the physical peril of a specific shipment leaving St. Kitts.
Demonstrate how that piece of paper was drafted while the physical barrels of sugar were being loaded onto a ship by exhausted, brutalized laborers.
Yes. Remind the reader that the abstract liquidity represented by the bill of exchange is literally made of the calories and the lives expended in the previous chapter.
Let's also consider how maritime insurance is treated in the text. The manuscript explains the underwriting process in London perfectly, but it needs to physically tether that underwriting to the ocean.
Right.
When a ship goes down, or when a cargo of human beings is cast overboard, the insurance claim completely erases the human tragedy and replaces it with a financial transaction. By physically tethering those two chapters together through these concrete examples, the manuscript forces the reader to realize that the quiet banking halls of Europe were running on the identical machine as the roaring, dangerous boiling houses of the Caribbean.
Yeah, and if you look at the mechanics of over-leveraging, A plantation owner takes out a mortgage to buy more land and more enslaved people to grow more sugar. They get trapped in a cycle where they must constantly increase production just to pay the interest on the debt.
The financial ledger demands a larger harvest, which means the whip falls harder in the cane fields.
Exactly. The violence is mathematically mandated by the debt. It is a profound realization when you see the math and the violence as the exact same thing. Making this structural edit will make the financial chapters just as gripping and terrifying as the chapters on physical labor.
And you know, by turning physical trauma into a clean, compounding financial asset, you create a new desperate problem, right? That immense debt now demands interest. And the only way to pay that compounding interest is to manufacture a massive, insatiable consumer appetite. Which brings us to the next big point, the conceptual bridge connecting historical plantation finance to modern industrial mass consumption lacks a sharp causal through line.
Okay, unpack that. Because you have this incredibly rich historical finance section and then this really fascinating section on the rise of modern industrial diets.
Yeah, the material beautifully details how sugar entered the industrial workforce, you know, sweetened tea, jam, baked goods in working class households.
It really captures how sugar became this technology of domestic care and industrial endurance, providing cheap, rapid energy for factory workers to survive grueling 14-hour shifts.
It does, but the text treats the rise of this industrial consumption almost as a parallel evolution. It describes the massive supply of sugar pouring out of the colonies and the growing demand for sugar in European cities as like two separate phenomena that just happened to meet and accelerate at the same time.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It misses the opportunity to explicitly state that the cultivation of the mass industrial appetite was a direct, desperate requirement of the plantation's compounding debt spiral. The debt mathematically forced the creation of the demand.
I wonder, though, if we push too hard on the idea of top-down engineered demand, is there a risk of overlooking the genuine agency of the working class?
How do you mean?
Well, factory workers weren't just mindless automatons eating sugar because a colonial ledger told them to, right? They actively used sugar for cheap calories, for a quick burst of warmth in a cold factory, for a tiny bit of domestic comfort in an otherwise brutal industrial existence. We don't want to erase their resourcefulness.
Oh, no, absolutely not. We cannot erase the agency of the working class, and the manuscript does a good job of showing how sugar functioned as a survival tool for them. The fix here isn't to portray the consumers as passive victims, but to explicitly frame the massive supply and aggressive marketing of sugar as a direct byproduct of the plantation's financial panic.
Right.
The creditors' relentless demands for repayment engineered the necessity for the working class sweet tooth.
So the industrial consumer was heavily cultivated because the creditor required a harvest.
Exactly. The working class found genuine utility in sugar, yes, but that utility was subsidized, packaged, and pushed upon them in an unprecedented scale because the plantation system was overleveraged and desperate to liquidate its inventory.
It's a closed, predatory loop. The debt fuels the whip, which fuels the harvest, which necessitates a massive market, which fuels the diet. Let's look at how the author can directly link the debt spiral from the finance chapter to the expansion of occasions in the consumption chapter.
Okay.
So the manuscript notes that sugar consumption expanded from a luxury item to something consumed at multiple occasions throughout the day, right? The tea break, the afternoon treat, the penny candy for children.
Yeah, and the author should explicitly show how a London merchant's demand for returns on an overleveraged St. Kitts estate forced the creation and marketing of that branded, cheap confectionery targeted at factory workers.
Because when a plantation is failing to meet its interest payments, it doesn't just grow less cane.
No, it grows more cane, desperate to clear the balance. But that massive influx of sugar needs somewhere to go.
So the system creates the penny sweet. It pushes the sweetened tea break as an industrial standard. You can frame it as transforming the creditor's financial panic into the industrial child's reward.
Wow, yeah. The financial panic of the colonial elite literally becomes the daily dietary habit of the working class.
Exploring the how and the why of that marketing push changes everything. It proves that the working class diet wasn't just, you know, a natural evolution of taste. It was an economic pressure relief valve for colonial debt.
Right. Making this causal link sharpens the final sections of the manuscript tremendously, Because when the book moves into the metabolic afterlife and modern public health crises like the soaring rates of diabetes, heart disease, metabolic syndrome, the impact is just staggering.
It proves that our modern chronic dietary conditions were quite literally engineered to satisfy 18th and 19th century ledgers.
The body of the modern consumer is carrying the historical weight of the displaced balance sheet.
That brings the entire argument full circle in such a devastating way. You look at a simple crystal of sugar on a kitchen table, and it appears so innocuous. But by forging this causal through line, the author allows us to trace that crystal backward.
We trace it through the aggressive marketing of the 19th century, through the compounding debt of the European banks, through the sanitized paper of the bills of exchange, and finally back to the blood and the soil of the Caribbean.
It transforms a historical timeline into a single breathing machine. It is a phenomenal piece of work, and I mean, making these structural alignments will only make its inherent brilliance more piercing.
Absolutely. All right, let's recap the main points of this critique. We covered three high-level structural opportunities to elevate this incredibly strong manuscript.
First, consolidate the defensive caveats into an upfront guardrail section. This clears the academic speed bumps, improves the narrative pacing, and basically lets the historical chapters hit the reader with absolute full force.
Second, use the displaced balance sheet metaphor to physically tether the abstract financial chapters directly to the trauma of the plantation machine. Don't just explain a bill of exchange. Show exactly how a wounded body in the sick house translates into a depreciated asset on a London mortgage.
And third, tighten the conceptual bridge between historical finance and modern consumption. Frame the rise of industrial mass consumption as a direct causal requirement of the plantation's compounding financial debt. Show how the elite's financial panic engineered the working class diet.
Exactly. We invite the listener to implement these structural edits and submit the revised manuscript back in for another critique to see how these changes impact the overall flow. Engaging with material of this caliber is exactly why we do this.
Because ultimately, when we look at the machinery of history, we shouldn't just see the abstract gears of commerce.
Right. We must see the physical toll in the ledgers, the panic in the markets, and the appetites engineered to keep the whole devastating machine running.